For example, in the Institute of Noetic Sciences, that's IONS, was initiated when the astronaut Edgar Mitchell was returning from his moon mission. And as he beheld the Earth, this beautiful globe in space, gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger before him, he realized that this place out of all the cosmos is where we are born, where we die, where we have our loves, our lives and our wars and our makeup and our cuddles. I'm just thinking of that too. So, and the next minute he had a moment of expanded consciousness, which is sometimes called cosmic consciousness, or in the East it's called samadhi. And he experienced, as is often the case with this experience, he experienced oneness with all existence and awareness of all knowledge, all love, and that affected him profoundly. And he determined that when he got back to Earth, he would found an organization which would investigate the realm of consciousness and knowledge and spirituality, because out of that experience, it is completely transformational. It's like the people who have a near-death experience, and they're documented now by the thousand. People who have one of these extremely illuminating near-death experiences have almost the same sort of experience, and they're generally totally transformed.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Some cloudless nights when we're far from the city and the evening is so clear and we look up at the diamond-studded panorama of starlight and gaze into the deep cosmic vault of our galaxy, we realize that there's so many profound questions that we do not know. Yet it was only a little over 100 years ago that big breakthroughs were happening in our study of what is life. And new knowledge was continuously coming to the fore, particularly with the Royal Society in England. And New Zealand's Lord Rutherford was there when he split the atom, and Albert Einstein said he was the first man to tunnel into God. In the studio this morning, I have Murray Stanford. Murray is a New Zealander. And he's come in this morning to speak and share some information, particularly about the invisible, as well as the possibility of the human species, and to, in particular, share on Geoffrey Hodgson, who was one of the greatest seers or clairvoyants on Earth in the 20th century. And so, kia ora, Murray.
And kia ora, Tim. It's great to be here.
Murray, I'm so glad that you come here because I've known you for nearly 20 years, and you are a physicist. You received your Master's in Physics from Auckland University, where you did research, but also you are a professional musician, and you can read and understand music. And this is also very important because it's invisible at one level, that we can't actually see music, but it can be seen if you have certain capabilities. So can you just tell us a little bit about your background? How did you come into wanting to study physics, but also study the unknown?
Well, I guess it goes right back to probably when I was born, because I don't remember a time when I did not have those interests. And for me, there's the interest in science, the knowledge of things, but also music too. I remember playing away at the piano at a very tender age, improvising things. And yeah, too, also the spirituality behind things. To me, it's an important, indeed a vital aspect of a holistic worldview. So those particular threads, like a braided river in the South Island, have run through my life right through. And yes, indeed, I've been a professional musician in the past, both orchestrally on the double bass, both in orchestras, but also in jazz groups a lot in the past.
Yes, to express yourself through sound is very important, particularly if you can put a melody to it and produce a song.
Oh, indeed, and even more so put a harmony to a melody, which I was always very good at, I might say.
Yes, well, harmonics across the board.
Yeah,
very
sure.
important for the human species.
Yeah.
If we're out of harmony, if we're in harmony, we can have a peaceful planet. Murray, your dad had influence on you too, didn't he? He had books that you read or he told you stories.
Oh, indeed, too. And I'm recalling how when I was about eight, a particular occasion when he is reading one of his Rosicrucian books there, and as at that particular tender age, I looked over at what he was reading and I thought, that is very, very interesting.
And you took it further then. You wanted to get a greater understanding of why we are human beings. Why are we here?
Well, exactly, too. And that interest arose and fell at different times after that. And including those, especially when I went to university, I had a part-time job. And I would often go down to the library and read books on religion or science or yoga, you know, different things like that.
Yes, because we human beings, in many ways, we're finding out more and more, but particularly in this day and age, because we have got the Hubble telescope that can look back into time. We have these electron microscopes that are now really, really highly tuned, and we can look into matter itself, and we're finding that beyond matter there is something else. But in many cases, science doesn't really want to know what happened, say, prior to the Big Bang.
Well, I don't know if they don't want to, but I think they realise they can't. They just explain it all away as a mystical point, a singularity, which is supposed to give rise to the whole universe. And I find it intriguing that when you add up the amount of dark matter and dark energy that is supposed to be out there in the universe, all that's left is only 4%, which means that all our pontificating and studies about science are about 4% of the universe from that slightly whimsical point of view.
Oh, that's interesting, because they say that when we study the human genome, we find that in actual fact, we've only got about 4% of the DNA decoded, and the other 96%, they're sort of thrown into the junk DNA box.
Oh, yeah, that was the case. Though I understand that the junk DNA, so-called, actually has some vital roles to play.
Oh, I have no doubt, just like the dark matter has a vital role to play. So essentially we're seeing just the tip of the iceberg, or less than the tip of the iceberg, of how life is. We don't know the great unknown.
Absolutely, too, and I think that Western science in particular has got itself into trouble by insisting that the only reality is one that we can observe with our five physical senses. And even those skeptics will decry anything to do with psi or psychic research as being unproved and just fanciful. Materialism itself, reductionist materialism itself, is just an assumption. It's just a hypothesis, and it gets very dogmatic, which, when you think about it, is one of the unpleasant aspects of organized religion. So I find it really intriguing to read what skeptics sometimes write and realize that they're exhibiting quite a few other characteristics of the tribalism, which is not always a wonderful characteristic for human beings.
Yes, and this mechanism, because in the mechanistic science sees us as all machines, really, and to some sort of degree the human body is like a machine, but it's far more pronounced than that.
Absolutely, too. It's a wonderful machine, and any time I look at anything else to do with the body, I'm filled with awe at the complexity and the aptness for function, you know, which it exhibits. And I would imagine many doctors and researchers would feel the same thing. But I'd like to make a bit of a word about skepticism. I see it as rather like the immune system of the mind. So I'm not decrying skepticism. I'm saying it's really, really important. But like the immune system of our bodies, it has to be working in balance. If it's underactive, we have problems. If it's hyperactive, we have other problems. So I think it's really, really good. And I hold that an open-minded skepticism is vital, especially when you're exploring non-physical things.
Yes, well, I was very fortunate that in this case, that my mother and father were either an atheist and an agnostic. And from time to time, I didn't know which was which. But they were kind, they were loving, they were honest, and they were caring. And so you can have a good life and still not follow a dogma.
Absolutely, too, Tim. And I think that we're gradually rediscovering that now today. And I have to think of the adventurous researchers. For example, in the Institute of Noetic Sciences, that's IONS, was initiated when the astronaut Edgar Mitchell was returning from his moon mission. And as he beheld the Earth, this beautiful globe in space, gradually getting bigger and bigger and bigger before him, he realized that this place out of all the cosmos is where we are born, where we die, where we have our loves, our lives and our wars and our makeup and our cuddles. I'm just thinking of that too. So, and the next minute he had a moment of expanded consciousness, which is sometimes called cosmic consciousness, or in the East it's called samadhi. And he experienced, as is often the case with this experience, he experienced oneness with all existence and awareness of all knowledge, all love, and that affected him profoundly. And he determined that when he got back to Earth, he would found an organization which would investigate the realm of consciousness and knowledge and spirituality, because out of that experience, it is completely transformational. It's like the people who have a near-death experience, and they're documented now by the thousand. People who have one of these extremely illuminating near-death experiences have almost the same sort of experience, and they're generally totally transformed.
Very much so, because they don't see life like it is anymore. They've made this connection to something greater. Eternal life.
Absolutely, too. And I think it's because they've touched the bedrock of their being. And everything else which is built up in a life of learning and experience in the physical world is like a superstructure that's built upon the bedrock of our consciousness, which I like to think we're born with and which we are able to return to after death.
Thank you, yes. Because the word psychology and psychiatry, the word psych, is Greek for soul.
Totally, yeah.
And what's happened is that present-day mechanistic reductionist science doesn't recognize the soul, and yet it's embedded in the language of psychology and psychiatry.
Completely too, and it's even embedded in this study of quantum mechanics, where it's almost like the elephant in the room, you know. Consciousness was inevitably associated with the observations in early quantum mechanics, where they looked at the motion of particles and photons through double slit experiments, for example. And as I say, it's always been a bit like the white elephant in the room. But again, it is a piece of dogma. It is an assertion and nothing more on the part of materialistic science that is the only significant underpinning of reality. It's the only thing that's real. And that our awareness, our very consciousness, is an epiphenomenon, a byproduct. And the crazy things that science itself is conducted entirely within consciousness. So there's something a little bit untoward here. I'm being kind and saying put it that way.
You're very kind, and it's important. Albert Einstein had a viewpoint that was very huge. I remember once I was in contact with the vice president of a British pantheist society, and he said Albert Einstein was a pantheist. He saw the whole universe as alive. He understood that it was very, very profound. And his famous statement that God doesn't play dice with the universe. And the other thing was that Nikola Tesla stated that when humankind started to study the invisible, we will evolve far faster in 10 years than all of our previous evolution. So the invisible is important, extremely important.
Indeed, too, and I couldn't agree more. And my observation is that there are growing numbers of young people who are naturally aware of the spiritual, the inner world. And indeed, I think a lot of them look around, especially the so-called indigo children, and say, what the beep are you carrying on like this for? And they often have a sense of being here to help to change the whole system and indeed sweep the nonsense off the table.
Yes. I was up in Hawaii once, and a radio announcer told me, this is back in the year 2000, she talked about indigo children and rainbow and crystal children, and she called them systems busters.
I love that.
But they are born into this world, and they're here to shake us adults down, because they know inherently that there is something majorly wrong with our disconnect from nature and disconnect from loving family and community. And so they will ask, as kiddies, they'll ask very pertinent questions. And they're here to shake us down so that we start to come together as a human and global family.
I think so too. And I think when we look around the world at the number of uprisings of the youth of different countries, it's a very promising sign too. And I'd like to speak to the idea that perhaps in decades past, if a child came in and began to talk about fairies in the garden, more often than not, the response of a parent would be, darling, well, that's not real, you know. And likewise about dreams. Dreams are not real. But from a deeper point of view, these children are, to my mind, perceiving aspects of reality which are extremely real. Why would it be that the little folk, you know, why are there that many different words, like brownies, elves, gnomes, sylphs, fairies, undines, salamanders? You know, there's a magnificent act of imagination if that's all it is, but I actually personally think that there has been in the past for most cultures a natural awareness of the non-physical beings and intelligences in nature.
I hear you. I know that shaman and medicine men have an understanding from their particular indigenous side, like in many cases with the Kachina of the Hopi in southwest USA. But when we have a look at the fairy tales that come out of Europe, there's all sorts of interesting things where you could actually see through the gaps in the world to see other things. And so, yes, there's a lot that we don't know, Murray. And can I throw this in to see if I can tie something in? There's the word Anima Mundi.
Yeah.
Anima Mundi.
That's right. And the soul of the world.
The world soul.
Feminine too.
And it's a Latin word.
Anima. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, all humans, animals, and biota are all connected with we all have a soul, and it interfaces in some greater reality. And just very much like a soul in the human body affiliates to our physical body, all these 7.7 billion human souls are part of some greater reality, interfacing even with the animal kingdom and the vegetable kingdom.
Well, I think so too. And in fact, one of the interesting discoveries of science in recent decades is the interconnectedness of everything. And that is a fundamental concept in many cultures and religions and spiritual traditions, and where I believe rediscovering the degree to which we're interconnected. And if you look at the spiritual wisdom of yoga, for example, and the wisdom of the East and other places, it very much comes from the idea that we are interconnected and we're multidimensional beings as well, and that our physical bodies are but the densest, most material aspect of ourselves. And so when the materialists boldly and somewhat bravely declare there's no such thing as a soul, A, it's a dogma, and B, I'm afraid you're outnumbered. It's been an observation of humanity right down that we have a dimension which is properly called the soul, and is beginning to swim into observational realm as well now too, with the cases of people who have a near-death experience while their body is on the operating table. And it's a small but interesting number of those who feel themselves, perceive themselves to have fluttered up to a corner of the room in a body of light, some of them say, and they're looking down at their cold, inert body down there. And even sometimes heard some of the things the doctors have said and told the doctors what they heard, and said doctors have blanched and they've gone a bit white in the face. but this is actually very exciting, that there are people who relate out of their first-hand experience, leaving their body and being in, well, a more subtle energy body.
There are now, as you say, thousands of reports, or hundreds of thousands of reports.
Yeah.
And there are doctors now. I mean, Raymond Moody started it way back, and Dr. Ken Ring also followed suit.
Yep.
And there are many, many. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she came here to Auckland and filled the Auckland Town Hall, 1,600 people.
Brave pioneer, such a wonderful woman.
That's right, and she interviewed 20,000 people over the course of her lifetime who had near-death or out-of-the-body experiences.
Yep.
And yet, for some unknown reason, to break through the wall that dogmatic science has put around this whole subject has to come to an end.
Indeed, too, and I believe it's falling apart right now. I think in the great paradigm shift or even explosion that's underway right now, that will be one of the aspects which is crumbling.
Yes, well, at the moment, I think we are in many ways, as the late Barbara Marx Hubbard clearly stated, we're in the birth canal to a great awakening and to a new paradigm.
Yes.
And we're squeezing through this birth canal and we're finding out so much more about life. And we're coming back to, in many ways, our spiritual homecoming.
We very much are too, and I think that journey is only part way, you know. I personally believe that there's as much evolution potentially ahead of us as there has been behind us. And this idea is explained very well in philosophies like the philosophy of yoga that I mentioned before, but also theosophy, which is a background, a worldview, which I've had a lot to do with myself. So I think we are just gradually rediscovering how to be whole. Only from a new point, there's a wonderful poem by T.S. Eliot. And I don't remember the exact words, but it's to the effect, to arrive where we began, but know it for the first time. And I think that wonderfully describes that the whole enterprise of the human species on this planet right now.
Very, very good, Murray, yes.
Mm.
And there's been lots of great thinkers. I mean, you go back to Plato, or before that, Pythagoras.
Mm.
These early Greeks knew that there was something else. They knew that we had soul.
Yep.
I mean, Socrates, the teacher of Plato, he said that when he was forced to die, he said, okay, you may kill me, but you won't kill my soul.
Good man.
And then you come all the way through from Paracelsus.
Yeah.
And we move all the way up, and there's certain mystics that came. There was Charles Leadbetter, was a very interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like you to be able to talk to the listeners about that, and then we can go on to Geoffrey Hodgson, because you spent quite a bit of time with Geoffrey Hodgson, and very, very lucky man to have hung out with him. So could you tell us a little bit about Charles Leadbetter, because he was able to actually see the subtle energy and the subtle bodies around our human body.
He did indeed too, and that would be the topic of a whole other interview. But the bit that seems right to focus on for now is that he engaged in a project of observing the number of what he saw as ultimate physical atoms within each ordinary physical atom. And he had a kind of clairvoyance, which was actually described in ancient yogic texts, of being able to make yourself very small and perceive the very, very small. He had developed that as a clairvoyant ability, and he found that when he looked at an atom of hydrogen, for example, that there seemed to him to be 18 of these little tiny particles. And when he applied a bit of energy to pull them apart, he discovered that if you pull them apart, it's no longer in the physical realm. So then the next question was, well, what about other atoms? How many little anu, as they call them, a Sanskrit word meaning little one, how many of those are there in different atoms? And they began this colossal project, enormously painstaking, of examining the atoms of different elements, and they worked through most of the periodic table as we know it, and found numbers which either agreed exactly, when divided by 18, they either agreed exactly with the atomic number of those isotopes, all were out by a bit, and the worst error, most of them were like 0.5%, 1% out, which is a bit phenomenal when you think the numbers are up in the thousands for the bigger elements, the bigger atoms. The one that was the most out was no more than 3% in error. But now here's the kicker. They discovered some atoms which were not known at the time, but subsequently we have identified isotopes which fill exactly those slots. So that stands as a pretty iconic piece of sci research, and I'm looking forward to the day when that work is actually developed further.
Yes. Is this element 115 or 117?
Technetium was one of them, I think, which breaks down in nature. And I've forgotten, one of them is deuterium. In those days, they didn't know about deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen with double the weight, double the mass, because the nucleus has a neutron in it as well. And I think they discovered the three component isotope of hydrogen as well. I've forgotten the name they gave it. They didn't know what to call it. They call one of them occultum, you know. Well, of course, we now know what these are, but that is so extraordinary. Really, because the point is, as that a sceptic would say, oh, but you expected to find those isotopes there. Nobody expected deuterium. Nobody expected tritium. Nobody expected technetium.
Yes.
You see, so this is cooking.
Yep.
This is significant.
Yes, there's a person called Bob Lazar up in America who was in Area 51.
Yeah, right.
And he was involved in a whole lot of, shall we say, deep cover stuff, and he himself came out with, I think, about element 115 or 117.
Yeah, okay.
And he'd got that from another, from left field, from the ET community,
okay,
etc. So what there is for listeners, get out the periodic table, do a search, drag it down, and have a look at it. It's fascinating in its own right.
It totally is too, yes. It's a very beautiful thing too, actually, with all the rare earths. In fact, only a couple of days ago, I heard somebody talking about rare earths, which are used in the magnets in our windmills, neodymium, and in the phosphors in the screens of our phones to produce the colours that we get. And interestingly, most of the sources of those are in China, but they've now discovered that there are probably a lot in Greenland. I will leave our listeners to work out the geopolitical implications of these two locations, China and Greenland.
That's right. Yeah, well, we'll trump that one, won't we?
Oh, that's right, too.
Yes, yeah, well, you see, again, and Charles Leadbetter could tell about the different numbers of subtle bodies around a human being, because most people say, oh, you're just a physical body, and you have emotions, and you have a mental realm and a mind, which a lot of people can't differentiate. And Leadbetter was, again, because he could see the invisible and the auric field. Can you just quickly tell us about that before we get on to Geoffrey Hodgson?
Yes, okay. He appeared by all accounts, and he wrote about the different energetic layers of the human aura. So the term astral body is well known today, and I think that is mainly because of the Theosophical Society. It got the language, a new language for these things out into the Western world, like astral and astral plane and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But he also spoke of more refined, more subtle levels of the human aura, and he described those. He's got a little book on the astral plane, a little book on the mental plane, as he called it. And one of the intriguing things was the discovery that a human thought, especially one with a lot of intense emotion behind it, creates an energy form of its own in those non-physical realms. And if it's a thought perhaps of affection towards a beloved pet, it apparently propels the emotion of that affection, propels this energy form or thought form towards the pet, and it hovers around the pet, gently radiating that beneficent, beautiful energy upon the pet.
Well, Rupert Sheldrake, who is a very unique scientist of today, he has a book called Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
Oh, yes, right.
And so over time and space, a dog or a cat can actually pick up the thoughts of the owner. And when the owner's away and is coming home, and I experienced it myself so many times with my pet cat, I'd come home and our cat would just jump through the gate and be waiting on the footpath for me. And Sheldrake proved that. But he also had something else which was really important. He maintained that our memory is held outside our brain. And you and I would both agree on that.
Well, I think so too. When you come from a worldview of ancient wisdom, as for example, theosophy and all the others like the Rosicrucians and the ancient wisdoms, indigenous wisdom like that, it's entirely natural to have non-physical bodies and energies around us. You know, why do Maori have a word like wairua? And yet other words as well, like ata, if I've got that right, ata.
Yes, atua.
And it's almost as if the Western world is rediscovering its own heritage, which I believe it did have many centuries ago.
Yeah, well, we've lost ourselves on the way, and now the crisis of our separation from the mystical war, separation from God, is coming back at us with all the challenges that are going around the world at the moment, from all the fires and the earthquakes and the societal disturbances. And this is the time now for us to reflect and think, what is it to be like a human? How can we come together and solve all our challenges? Because we can't go further on down this track because it's going to take us over multiple tipping points.
I think too, now when I stand back a bit, I think there actually is a sort of long-term evolutionary function, and that it has been important to bring logic and rationality and observation, all these gifts of science. I think that they have been vitally important to counteract the superstition which often reigns supreme before it. So I think, in fact, it's playing a vital role, but a bit like a pendulum that has swung very far towards the materialistic way of seeing things and splitting things up analytically into their component parts. And now's the time of synthesis and perceiving the connectedness and once more the wholeness of everything. And that's a big view. I don't know whether it's centuries or millennia.
You've cracked it, Murray. Yes, because this is it. We've gone so far on the pendulum upswing. Now we're coming into a deeper understanding, and we need to. We just need to come together. I'm speaking with Murray Stenterford, who's a Auckland physicist and musician who's had a 65 years of study into the mystery schools about the spiritual and metaphysical qualities that we can all awaken to in us as a human species. And he's here to remind us of who Geoffrey Hodgson was and what he did in his life. With your time with this person called Geoffrey Hodgson,
right?
He wrote many, many, many books, but one of his key books that I enjoyed hugely was Music Forms, which I've got a copy, and also The Kingdom of the Gods, and where he was able to see these great beings overlighting certain areas. Even here in New Zealand, he could see these beings overlighting Rangitoto Island, One Tree Hill, and also Tongariro in Narahoe. Can you tell us about your time with him? Because nobody really knows of his great significance.
Thank you indeed. Now, again, I could speak for a long time, but to be succinct, he was a highly gifted seer and clairvoyant, and his mission, his primary mission in life, was to investigate what he saw as the embedded intelligences in nature, non-physical intelligences. And there'll be amongst our listeners people who can think of the Findhorn Garden, which is like a forerunner in the Western world of that process of discovery. But he had a very highly developed ability, and he documented that in his early books written around about the 1920s. He also worked with doctors at the time. He wanted to place his abilities at the disposal of professionals in different fields, like scientists and musicians, so they could ask him questions that were significant questions in their field, and he would examine them clairvoyantly, his purpose being to illustrate the potential of superphysical abilities for exploring nature. And he did that over and over again. And to skip forward a long way, when he discovered that I had a background, professional background, in both science and music, he thought, I might invite this man to come and help me do another round of music form research, and also maybe some other research into micro psi, like the structure of atoms and things once again. That is how the music form work began.
And can you tell listeners a little bit about this? In the book that I had, Music Forms, it shows these radiant pictures of sound that appears pushing out and up into the sky because of the high notes of the music at that particular time. I mean, I'm not really describing it properly, but you may be able to do far better.
Well, the first thing that I realized was that his perceptions were in more than three dimensions and were in living, flowing energy. So the very act of producing a picture in a book, as he did with some very patient artists, was itself an enormous achievement. But he did want to indicate the overall energy form. I've mentioned the energy of thoughts and thought forms, but music likewise, because it's based upon musical intention and stirs emotion, also creates these energy forms, which are perceptible to people who have even only a small degree of heightened vision. And one of the intriguing bits is that there are different shades of colour associated with the different pitches of musical notes and different textures as well to do with the tones of the instruments. And when I did eventually begin to help him, we investigated that a little bit. And what we discovered is that the correlation between pitch and colour is not straightforward. Now, I happen to know a number of musicians who naturally perceive like a green along the note D and something else with F. But I've also realised that there are other correlations. So we never got to the bottom of this, but it's just interesting to know that that the human senses have cross-linkings. Synesthesia is the name of that phenomenon, where if you hear a sound, you perceive a colour, and vice versa. And he is very interested in that.
Well, from what I gather, the great composers in Europe, people who listened to their music could actually see colour in their mind.
Well, they did too, but absolutely true, yeah, and I'm aware that Beethoven, for example, perceived particular colours with particular notes. But I think it went well beyond that. I think that people like a Mozart, who was basically a pipe up into the cosmic reservoir of music, and he just had to turn the tap on and it flowed through, whereas for Beethoven it was very different. It was a much more torturous process. But I am sure that they had a visual component of music, what I do myself. I mean, I'm not putting myself anywhere near those great musicians, but just as a matter of first-hand experience, I'm able to be playing a work of music in my mind, but at the same time try, almost like playing on a different instrument, a bar, two, three, four bars ahead of it. So I can have multiple tracks of music going on in my head as well. Okay, and it's also a bit visual too.
Debussy, I find, is very interesting. They classified him as a tonal.
Wow, yeah, not quite. Yeah,
A tonal. His, some of his music was just profound.
Incredibly, yes.
Yes, and
it wasn't strictly atonal, though.
Okay, and so Maurice Ravel.
Yeah.
He too was a very interesting composer, because when you sit and listen to their music, you can actually see visuals.
Mm. And you too, then. So,
pardon?
I just spoke the words, you too. And the trick would be to find people who don't. It might be hard now to find people who don't have a visual experience with music.
That's right, but we have to also make sure that the visual is such that it takes you to a really lovely place. And I think that is very soothing, because we know that young youth today are listening to such aggressive music
often,
that they're getting very, very dark images. And this is where the importance of knowing what to listen to, because you'll find that, regrettably, a lot of youths who take their own lives, if you check out what they're listening to at the time, the sound is extremely based around the bass, that the lyrics are horrendously bad, virtually hateful music or hateful sounds, and when what we're really wanting is to have our being soothed.
I think so, and yet once again, as with my attitude towards materialism, I think to a certain degree there is an evolutionary purpose in this, and that those highly destructive sounds, as not all of them are, but the ones that are tending, I think, to break up the thought patterns of the past. Might believe that negative energies like that, prolonged and persisted in, are not good for you. Let's just put it that way. But I want to say something else as well, which is that seeing images, I do not conflate or confuse seeing visual images in your brain with the fully developed clairvoyant of a Geoffrey Hodgson. That was another order of magnitude again.
It was a gigantic order.
Yeah.
I mean, he took us octave upon octave above anybody else can see. Can you talk about this? Because in his book, Clairvoyant Investigations, he showed even a Davidic presence. Could you describe a Davidic presence for people? In the best words you can,
I will try to. I'm trying to describe the physically indescribable again, but it doesn't deter me, as you will see.
Lovely.
This connects back with the understanding of intelligence as embedded in nature, And like the human being, who in this picture has different energy levels from the densest of the physical body to non-physical ones, the whole universe is seen as being the same too. So from that point of view, we're living in a vast sort of ocean, a multidimensional ocean of life, and then it becomes completely natural to hold the idea of devas and beings like that too. And he would observe these tall devas perhaps holding station over mountains. And I suspect that one of the reasons that mountaineers love to go up mountains, they might not know this or admit it or anything like that, but is because of the rarefied and intense psychophysical or psychospiritual energies up there to do with the devas.
Euphoric,
they are potentially so close to it. Well, you know, easy doorway into euphoria. Yeah, quick.
Yes, well, I know that on his book, Clairvoyant Investigations, there's a picture of, I think, a Davic energy is coming over One Tree Hill and the National Women's Hospital, where so many babies are born into this world.
Exactly, too. And those who have researched the Deva kingdom have found that they have many different kinds of roles in nature and in life. And that includes healing the beings of the elements, like the oceans. Apparently, there are whole orders of Devas and nature spirits who energize the waters with non-physical energy. I should point out, I'm not denying to any degree the reality and significance of physical energy, but I'm saying the universe has much more, that's all. So there are perceived to be the devas of the oceans, of the air, the earth, plants, forests, healing, music, spiritual ritual, many, many different departments.
And they are overlighting.
Well, yes, both Jeffrey Hodgson and Ledbetter have described the healing devas or angels, I'm using those words interchangeably, holding station over a hospital and helping to improve all the healing outcomes and processes there.
In Findhorn, when I was in Findhorn way back in 1977, they talked about a landscape angel overlighting the garden, and this is why they had huge, gigantic cabbages and roses growing in snow and 12-foot delphiniums, and there were lots of very, very profound and interesting things there.
Absolutely, too. And Hodgson observed lots of those as well, as you're speaking of the book. Both books, The Kingdom of the Gods and also Clairvoyant Investigations, they both have quite a large number of landscape angels of different kinds. And that includes even those over volcanoes. Even a dormant volcano often has a Kundalini or fire deva holding station over it. The Maori described how Rangitoto blew up a few hundred years ago. I think it's around about 800. But Hodgson also looked at that mountain and he found there's still a huge fire deva there, extant and active over Rangitoto.
Yes, I mean, if we only had the eyes to see, or the inner vision to see.
Well, we're heading that way, I think.
Yes, it's a long road, a journey. And this is the rebirth of our connection with nature.
It is too, and with the advantage of a well-developed logical mind, it's now time to bring in the role of restore emotion to its proper role, that's good lighted positive emotion, and also spirituality towards the ultimate goal of seeing the human being as a truly integrated cosmic phenomenon.
So much so, and it's time again for a duty of care, of allowing compassion to come in. And we notice this in so many ways with, in the nature kingdom, the mothers of all the animals. And the mothers are always there taking care of their cubs or their kittens, of their babies. And so we see the nurturement of the, should we say, the divine feminine being shown. And this is a time of great, we can call it awakening, but it's time for the human species to recognize the potential that lies within us and our intuition.
Quite so too, and I'd like to add that Jeffrey Hodgson also observed the devas present at a birth. And I personally think that their heightened energy and their nurturing compassion helps to reduce pain and helps to uplift the consciousness of the mother too. There are indeed descriptions of that, but it's good to know there's no life untended in this universe if we only open our awareness to that possibility.
Yes, yes. And with our technology becoming more refined, I remember way back about 40 years ago, they had Kirlin photography.
Oh, yeah, the Kirlin, yeah.
That's right. Mm. And they photographed the person, and I could see different colours coming from different people and different sizes of auras, of their aura.
Yeah.
And there was a way to sort of discern what energies were coming off certain people. And so this is just another form of understanding that their energies coming off our body. And we've had pictures of Kirlin photography on a leaf, and then they cut the leaf or half a leaf off, and then they photograph it, and then over time that energy falls away.
And to the outline, the original outline of the leaf is understood to often be visible as well, even though the piece is now missing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so again, our technologies are slowly catching up, all the way back to 19th century when they had x-rays and they could x-ray the human body. Well, now we can see a certain amount of the human body, but...
Well, there are a lot of amazing diagnostic machines being developed now since the Kirlian, and that again is another topic, but it's a very interesting realm of exploration. From the point of view of ancient wisdom and indeed timeless wisdom, the universe itself is a living, holistic system. And I like to think that our part in it is a combination of magnificent diversity as the expression of this holistic, singular, creative consciousness embraced within an all-embracing unity. And I think that that is not a new idea. It was known in ancient Greece. It's known in India, Egypt, just about everywhere that it's a conscious universe. We are, I think, as a global entity, humanity, gradually rediscovering the richness and depth of that journey towards a global consciousness.
Last month I was in Pythagorea on the island of Samos.
Wow.
In the Aegean, and that is where Pythagoras was born. And he, in his many musings about existence, he said, if we can sit still, we can hear the music of the spheres because every planet spins at a particular velocity and every planet has got a musical note. He said we could hear the orchestra or the symphony of life in this particular quadrant of the galaxy.
And I think there are different ways of understanding that. I suspect there are strong superphysical notes or energies associated with the planets. There's also the very, very slow, low frequencies of their rotation around the sun. I mean, it's a hyper-mega-low frequency, but still, it's a repetitive cyclic phenomenon.
Yes, yes. So what we're here to do, Murray, is help the invisible become more visible to people.
Yes, I like that. I couldn't agree more, too. And that's awakening our innate capacities, and I think rediscovering our human heritage of potential and gradually bring it into realization and activity.
Very true. I mean, we go back 2,000 years and we hear of a being walking or levitating over water. I mean, we hear of so many different stories about how we can do so much if we are aligned with a divine or a greater purpose.
I would agree too, and although we have called those things miracles in the past, I think the discovery path now is the law, if you like, the cosmic law or principles behind supposedly miraculous things. And we already have amazing healing techniques, you know, around the place, like EFT and the tapping therapies, and there are the medical intuitives, and there's a whole lot occurring, I think, in the realm of healing and the non-physical perception and interaction with the body.
You see, one of the things too is that some say that this great awakening is actually awakening to the Godhead, to our connection to God, because in our life we've become somewhat fragmented and dysfunctional on certain levels because we have not become whole. We've gone the opposite way. And as you say, the pendulum is swinging back now for us to be able to breathe deeply into our being of the holy breath and realize that we are energy bundles of exponential potential.
Oh, I like that term, you know. It would be hard to improve on that one. I should walk out of here when it's over and say, I have exponential potential.
That's right. And at heart, this is what we want to express when we really... Most people are doing their best all the time within the limited framework of their knowingness. But if we could just take the lid off and beyond the filmiest of screens, we'll be able to see so many other things in nature that only the seers, the shaman, the witch doctor, the tohunga, and the priests and the priestesses of yesteryear could actually see.
And the magic of our time is the way places like the Institute of Noetic Sciences are researching the bridge between science and consciousness and documenting huge amounts of cases of the way our consciousness can affect matter. And I'm thinking too of mothers who, for example, of World War One, mothers who have suddenly heard, seen or felt their son in anguish at the moment of his death overseas. And there are apparently thousands of those, you know. When we put this information together, there's already a mountain of evidence to suggest to the materialist that maybe my present worldview is time to hang up and look for a better one, a bigger fit.
Because way back in the 1960s, the Russians had a mother rabbit on electrocardiograph, and they took her five baby bunnies in a submarine from Leningrad all the way down to the South Pacific and then went down about 200, 300 metres under the water and had her five babies. And at different times, they took the life of a baby and every time the mother jumped.
Right.
And so what it's saying is that we are all connected within the bios there.
Absolutely.
Yes, this is a cruel experiment, but
for
how many deaths at the moment in the Amazon jungle is happening in the fires, and how many deaths in these mindless wars that are going on. And, and this brings all it to a focus there when Geoffrey Hodgson, when he came to New Zealand, he brought vegetarianism to New Zealand, or veganism, what was it, vegetarianism?
Well, he founded the Vegetarian Society, and he was very much spearheading a group which had the law around abattoirs changed to reduce the suffering of animals.
Yes, I agree, because when I was in Findhorn, they was talking about anybody who visited an abattoir, even here in New Zealand, would see a dark thought form or a dark energy over each freezing work, which was the fear and the pain and that animals were expressing at the time that they were being herded in, because they knew their life had finished.
Yes, Annie Besant perceived that when approaching Chicago once many, many years ago in a train from miles off. To her clairvoyant vision was this awful, dark, energetic pull over Chicago, and it was directly associated with the abattoir there.
Because right across the plains of North America, they were all these, the trains took all these cows and or steers or bullocks to that big freezing work, because that's where it all happened, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge, huge concentration of animals going through that freezing work.
Okay, yeah.
And so, Murray, on a lighter side, what can we do? What can we, as a human, do to lighten our perspective on life and to basically spiritualize matter?
I think one of the most spiritual words we have now is uttered by people when they walk outside on a clear starry night and say, wow. Now, I say that intentionally. It's that natural sense of awe, you know, which is primary connection with source energy, no matter how we conceive it or don't conceive it. I think that's really vital, and important things we can do are just learn to connect with each other, build community more, have beauty around yourself at home. Don't work 21 hours a day, you know. Make sure you tend the body as well as, mind you, I need to hear this lesson myself sometimes, but there are many things we can do to help to upshift our consciousness or as that wonderful man Beyond Ananda would say, to upwise ourselves, to have an upwising, which of course, you know.
That's right, an upwising is what we require on Earth at the moment.
Totally, yeah. I think war is well past its use by date.
That's right. We need to just recognise, one, our family and our neighbourhood.
Indeed, our connections.
And our community. Mm. And be involved, because what is one thing that I've found, there are so many good human beings. If you're putting out good vibes, there's a very good chance you're going to get good vibes back. The old saying, we create our own reality, we draw to ourselves what our own thoughts are, and in most cases, that can happen. Most cases...
Yes, there's much truth to that. I'm not saying it's the whole story, but...
Yes.
Because the book called The Secret actually held back a few things.
Yes, it did.
But that's very true. Like, our interior environment of habitual thoughts and energies tends to attract one that relates to it and resonates with it outside.
Yeah. And the old adage of random acts of kindness.
Oh, yes, that's fun.
It is fun. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And paying it forward. I like that.
It's very cool.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Anything else, Murray?
No, I think that's about it, actually.
Okay, Murray, because there's one thing you talked about, Captain Edgar Mitchell and noetic sciences. I saw him on stage back in the 1980s up in the States at a, I think, Body, Mind, and Spirit Festival. And he said that whilst he was on the moon, he had some mental telepathy experiments with people here back on Earth.
All right.
That he had. And he said he had something like well over 50% of them successful. And he realized then that over time and space, our thoughts have wings, and they're instantaneous.
And that's quite a good distance to do that experiment at, you know, just cool. Yeah. 330K, whatever it is, 330,000.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, a man who came back dedicated to finding out how we, as a human race,
indeed,
can sort ourselves out.
Absolutely.
And break into a new paradigm.
Absolutely, yes.
One of love. And one of the global family coming together.
Yes, yes, yes. And innate goodness of most people that you described just a while ago, and service to others.
Yeah. Yes, service to the whole.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Thank you, Murray. Thank you. Excellent.
Right. You're most welcome, Tim. It's been fun.
Okay, good man.
Take care.
Cheers, brother.
Cheers, mate.
That was Murray Stenderford talking about the hidden energies behind life, David Kingdom, and Geoffrey Hodgson, the great seer. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies. But of 7.7 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Mueller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha. wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ra.